It was quiet on Union Avenue that morning. The kind of quiet that feels wrong before you even know why. The house looked normal from the street. Calm. Untouched. The silence almost convincing. Almost. Inside, a bedroom door hung off its frame, splintered open. Blood streaked toward a window blown apart by gunfire. And outside that window, lying in the cold, damp grass, was a woman who had tried to escape, ran, climbed, fought, and still never made it past the sill. Shell casings were scattered like confetti, glass glittering around her like ice. Her name was Alicia Lofton. And long before police arrived, the fuse leading to this moment had already been lit by a secret Alicia had reportedly uncovered in the hours before her death. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Hey there. The story I have for you today is heavy. It's about what happens when a woman finally chooses herself, sets a boundary, and says, "I'm done." For people who respect you, that's the end of the conversation. But for someone who sees you as theirs to control, that's the spark that lights the fuse. All right, let me tell you how it all played out. Hear that quiet? Yeah, that's where everything ended. But to understand how it got there, we have to go back. Just a little. To Grand Rapids, Michigan. A Midwestern city with tree-lined streets and morning routines that don't ask much of anyone. Just another day starting the way it always does. Calm. Still. Ordinary. But on this morning, Thursday, August 17th, 2023, something felt off. Not loud, not dramatic, just off. The kind of quiet that feels too heavy for what's supposed to be a normal start to the workday. And in the minutes that followed, that quiet was about to crack wide open. A few minutes before the call ever reached dispatch, residents along Union Avenue heard it. Not one shot, not two, but a rapid burst that shattered the quiet of the morning. At least 15 gunshots. Then nothing. A kind of stunned silence that made neighbors freeze in place and turn toward their windows, waiting, listening, hoping it wasn't what it sounded like. Someone finally picked up the phone. A 911 call. Shots fired near a home on the southeast side. Possible domestic. A minute later, a second 911 call came in. An unresponsive female lying next to 1411 Union Avenue Southeast. It was just after 8 a.m. on Thursday, August 17th, 2023, when officers pulled onto Union Avenue. They were responding to two calls, one reporting shots fired, the second reporting an unresponsive woman lying outside 1411 Union Avenue. From the street, nothing looked disturbed. No broken door, no shouting. No movement at all. Officers approached the yard first, because that second call couldn't wait. And there she was, a woman lying in the grass beneath a window, motionless, surrounded by shell casings, blood spatter against the siding, and shards of glass catching the morning sun. They checked for a pulse. Nothing. Backup was requested. Crime scene tape started going up, and officers expanded their search. Looking not just at what happened outside, but where it began, The house needed to be cleared. They knocked. No answer. They called out. Still nothing. So they went in. Inside, everything shifted. The air felt wrong. Still, but charged. Down the hallway, a bedroom door hung off its hinges, kicked open, splintered wood scattered across the floor. Inside that bedroom, there was a trail, small drops, streaks, pulling toward a shattered window on the far side of the room. It didn't take long for officers to connect the scene inside with the woman lying outside. As they worked the case, they began piecing together who lived in the home and who she might be. Property records, mail on the counter, a purse inside. Alicia Danielle Lofton. So, who was Alicia Lofton? She was 38, a mother of three, a woman her family describes as warm, sharp, and full of that steady kind of love people leaned on without even realizing it. Her kids were her compass. Every decision she made circled back to them, their future, their stability, the kind of life she wanted them to rise into. And if you ask the people who loved her, they'll tell you Alicia carried joy in a way that made rooms feel lighter. She laughed easily, celebrated hard, and didn't believe in showing up halfway for the people she cared about. She liked looking good, enjoyed posting her outfits, and had a confidence that showed in the way she moved, the way she smiled, the way she talked about the life she wanted to build. She was beautiful. If you'd ever scrolled through her social media, you'd see it instantly. Alicia was in love. And the man at the center of it all was Marcus Lofton. To understand this story, you also have to know the man she chose, Marcus Dureau Lofton. Bug, as his friends called him. In Grand Rapids, people knew him. Not just because he stood out, but because he liked standing out. He was a dresser, designer shoes, crisp outfits, the type who ironed his image as carefully as his clothes. Marcus liked to be seen, liked being the man with style, the man people talked about. Some described him as a gentleman, a man who'd pick up a tab, give generously, and look out for the people in his circle. But he also carried a reputation. Flashy, charismatic, a ladies' man who loved attention, moved fast, and didn't always run in the cleanest circles. He had past charges, weapons, narcotics, the kind of history that made some people wary and others intrigued. And one more thing, people who knew him always said, Marcus didn't go public with women. He might date them, hang out with them, spend time with them, but he didn't put them on his page, didn't show them off, didn't give them that front and center spot in his life. Not until Alicia. When Alicia and Marcus got together, people noticed the shift immediately. They posted each other, a lot. Videos of them joking around, playing games, dancing, laughing, teasing one another with that playful online chemistry that made everything look easy. It was stylish, fun, full of personality. Two people who looked like they matched each other's energy. Alicia liked looking good. Marcus liked being seen. And together they built this little digital world where it looked like love, partnership, and a future were all taking shape. Friends said Alicia treated him with real affection, and that for once, Marcus seemed willing to put a woman in the spotlight with him. But online images don't always tell the story. And as detectives would soon learn, there was more happening behind those smiles than anyone realized. By the time detectives arrived on the morning of August 17th, the scene was already secured. Paramedics confirmed what everyone feared, and the medical examiner began documenting the area around Alicia's body. Inside the house, forensic teams moved room by room, reconstructing the last moments before the shooting. The first thing they noticed? No forced entry. The front door was intact. The back door was untouched. Every window was secure, except the bedroom window Alicia was found beneath. That alone told detectives something critical. Whoever was inside that bedroom wasn't a stranger. They found the bedroom door, kicked open, splinters scattered across the floor. Inside the room were clear signs of a struggle. Items knocked over, drops of blood on the floor, a streak pattern on the wall near the window frame, and shattered glass spread across the floor below it. Only after documenting those clues did detectives begin forming a picture of what likely happened. That Alicia may have tried to get out through that window in a desperate attempt to get away from whoever was inside the room with her. Outside, the scene reinforced that theory. Shell casings littered the grass. Shards of glass were scattered below the window. And Alicia's body lay directly beneath it, with no signs she had been dragged or moved. To detectives, it looked like she fell or collapsed right where she landed. While detectives processed the yard, officers canvassed the neighborhood, and that's when the story began to sharpen. A neighbor next door reported hearing arguing earlier that morning, raised voices, tension, and then suddenly a rapid burst of gunfire. At least 15 shots, then silence. That neighbor also mentioned something else, a maroon SUV pulling away quickly from the house right after the gunfire stopped. And when detectives matched the address to its residence, one detail stood out. The house was home to Alicia and her husband, Marcus Lofton, a man known to drive a maroon SUV. So procedurally, that made Marcus the next person officers needed to find, not because they had proof, but because when there's no forced entry, a struggle begins inside the bedroom, and a car matching the husband's leaves moments after gunfire. You don't waste time building a suspect list. You start with the one person whose timeline matters most. Because in investigations like this, the spouse isn't an optional conversation. They're step one. But when detectives tried to reach Marcus, he didn't answer. He didn't show up at the house. And no one seemed to know where he'd gone. And that silence, that sudden, unexplained absence, would be the first real sign that something much deeper was unfolding behind the scenes. When detectives couldn't reach Marcus by phone and couldn't locate him at any known addresses, they widened their search. They checked his recent cell activity, and the usage pattern didn't make sense. Bursts of movement, then silence. Sudden gaps. Pings that didn't match any place he was supposed to be. They reached out to friends and acquaintances, trying to find anyone who'd seen him that morning. But the answers they got were vague, short, evasive. And that was enough to shift Marcus from the spouse we need to notify to a person we need to find immediately. As officers continued canvassing, detectives began speaking with Alicia's family and friends, people who knew the couple behind the posts and the public smiles. That's when the first cracks came into view. Detectives learned the family didn't know much about the relationship at all. Alicia's father, Arthur, had only met Marcus once, and he didn't approve. Her aunt and other close relatives had never met him, never spoken to him, and couldn't offer any real insight into who Marcus was or what the relationship had actually looked like. Detectives pushed through the night, tracking leads, checking addresses, and monitoring his known hangouts. Then on August 18th, just one day after Alicia's death, officers saw Marcus walking along the 1200 block of North Avenue Northeast in Grand Rapids. Moments later, he was in handcuffs. He was taken to police headquarters for questioning, a 2.5-hour interview, raw, chaotic, and filled with profanity and outbursts that detectives later described as telling. Within minutes of sitting down, Marcus broke into tears. He told detectives he loved his wife, but said she constantly accused him of cheating. He claimed that when he moved into her home, she depleted all his money on her house and bills. He said he believed she was having secret meetings with their realtor and was planning to keep the profit once the house was sold. He insisted he'd only gone to the home that morning to pack up his things, that he left, then came back later. This time, he said, Alicia was awake and moving around the house. According to Marcus, they argued. And the moment Alicia told him he needed to get everything together for her new man, he snapped. And when detectives pressed him to explain what snapped actually meant, his story took an even darker turn. He claimed that in that moment, he lost control completely. In his own words, he said he went to the white table in the foyer, opened a drawer, pulled out Alicia's gun. Alicia asked, "Now what are you going to do with that?" And when he swung it at her, striking her in the head, the gun went off. He claimed he couldn't think straight, that everything around him went blurry, that he felt nothing but rage. "I couldn't hear shit. I couldn't see shit. Everything around me was blurry. I had all this rage." He told detectives Alicia had served him with divorce papers just one day earlier, and that they had been living apart since May, after she filed for an order of protection that was ultimately granted. But he said it was her comment about moving on, especially with someone else, that sent him into a spiral. Then he told detectives something that made even seasoned officers pause. "I don't even know how many times I shot her, to be honest." But detectives knew. They'd already counted at least 15 shell casings at the scene. And while detectives listened to his version of events, others were digging into his background. And that's when the rest of the picture came into focus. A colorful past. Multiple felony run-ins with the law. And that active order of protection on file since May, stemming from a violent incident inside this same home. He wasn't supposed to be there. Not that morning. Not the day before. Not ever. Legally, Marcus was barred from that house. And as detectives kept digging, they learned something else. A few months into their relationship, Alicia and Marcus had decided to make things official. On February 26, 2023, they got married in a secret ceremony. Just the two of them. A marriage no one in her family even knew existed. And not long after, he moved into her home. Checking into their online activities, it looked like everything was good. Smiling pictures, inside jokes, a playful chemistry that made people think they were happy, maybe even perfect for each other. And for a while, maybe they were. But perfection online rarely tells the whole story. In messages retrieved from Alicia's phone, detectives learned about a lead-up of arguments, jealous accusations, and escalating tension. This wasn't a couple calmly splitting up. This was a separation unraveling at the seams. By the time the interview ended, Marcus was charged with open murder, felony firearm, possession of a firearm by a felon, domestic violence-related violations, and multiple counts tied to ignoring the protection order. Up until this point, detectives thought they had a clear picture. A marriage unraveling, a separation turning volatile, divorce papers delivered the day before the shooting. But it wasn't the full story. Because what pushed this case from tense to explosive wasn't just what was happening inside the home. It was what was happening online. And it started with something Alicia's friends say she discovered during her own digging. They say Alicia posted Marcus's picture in a popular Facebook group called "Whose Man Is This?" And the responses came fast, but not from women, and not from people claiming innocent flirtations. According to her friends, the messages that poured in were from men who said they'd been intimate with her husband. And then came what her friends described as the breaking point. Alicia had allegedly gotten hold of a video, one she believed showed Marcus in an intimate encounter with another man. Her friends said the footage had been recorded secretly, shared without Marcus's knowledge, and passed around long before Alicia ever saw it. But the moment that sent the conversation into overdrive, the man in the alleged video uploaded the footage directly into the comments, claiming he was the one who recorded it. According to her friends, this wasn't drama to Alicia. It wasn't jealousy. It wasn't rumor. It was betrayal layered with humiliation, public, personal, and shared in real time across social media. Her friends said she was shocked, hurt, but also resolute. She wasn't going to hide what she'd learned. They said she went live on Facebook to address the situation, to say exactly what she'd found and exactly where she stood. And those who watched said she spoke with the kind of clarity people get when they're finally done being lied to. And then, almost as quickly as it went up, Alicia's Facebook page disappeared. Friends later claimed she didn't take it down on her own. Rumors spread that Marcus may have pressured her to deactivate it. For Marcus, though, true or not, this wasn't just a relationship unraveling. It was exposure, an outing of a side of himself he likely never wanted circulating at all. And that online fallout, the accusations, the alleged video, the sudden loss of control over his public image, poured gasoline on a situation that was already burning. By the time Alicia was killed, the story playing out behind the scenes was far more complicated than a marriage ending. A supposed secret had surfaced, publicly, suddenly, and in a way Marcus likely never expected. Between the alleged video shared in the group, the comments from men claiming involvement, and Alicia's decision to speak openly about it, everything he may have thought was buried was suddenly out in the open. And now, detectives had to piece together how much of that digital storm tied into the rage Marcus described in his interview, and the 15 bullets that took Alicia's life. With Marcus's interview on record, detectives moved quickly, not to theorize, but to solidify the case. This next phase wasn't about emotions or speculation. It was about evidence, cold, technical, and impossible to walk away from. Detectives already knew this much. Marcus had been served divorce papers. And less than 24 hours later, his wife of 6 months was dead, shot at least 15 times. Even without the gun, which Marcus admitted throwing away before police found him, the evidence locked into place. The shell casings recovered outside were all consistent with the same caliber and ammunition Alicia kept in the drawer he claimed he opened. Trajectory analysis told an even clearer story. Multiple shots fired toward the window. Additional shots fired downward after Alicia had already fallen into the yard. The autopsy documented at least 15 gunshot wounds to her shoulder, back, thigh, and 7 to her head. Every angle, every impact, every spent casing pointed to sustained intent, not a blackout, not a stumble, and not a single chaotic moment. When forensic examiners lined up the bullet trajectories, the blood patterns, and the placement of shell casings, they found no version of events where this was an accident or a single moment of panic. It was sustained, repeated, intentional. She wasn't just shot, she was pursued. With all of that locked in, prosecutors filed charges. Bond was denied. The case moved forward. At his first appearance, Marcus stood silent as the charges were read. The prosecution made it clear they intended to take the case to trial. Pre-trial hearings followed. Motions, evidentiary debates, the usual legal choreography. But when the jury selection finally began, that's when the real story came into focus. It took 2 long years before the case finally went to trial in May of 2025. Inside the courtroom, jurors listened as prosecutors walked them through a moment-by-moment reconstruction of Alicia's final minutes. Forensic experts testified to the bullet trajectories, the positions of the casings, and the autopsy findings. Detectives explained the timeline, where Marcus was, when he fled, how the scene contradicted his version of events. And then came the interview. Portions of the 2.5-hour interrogation were played for the jury. His profanity, his crying, his admission of rage, his claim of a blackout, His acknowledgement that he didn't know how many times he fired. It was compelling, damning even. Marcus took the stand in his own defense, repeating the same version he gave detectives.
Good afternoon, it's the afternoon, sir. So you and Alicia were married on February 27, 2023?
26.
Sorry, February 26, 2023, right?
Yes.
And that was in Vegas?
Yes.
Did any of her children attend that wedding?
No, I didn't think it was me or her.
Yeah, okay. And then there was a domestic violence incident on May 17, 2023, correct?
Yes.
You were arrested.
I don't know if that's a good day, but I know it was in May.
All right, and so there was no contact order? You weren't supposed to be at the house?
Yes.
All right, but you were at the house quite a lot, right?
Yes.
Violating the no contact order?
Yes.
And you, let's talk about that day. So you said earlier that, or I should say during your interview, that you left that morning after you woke up on the couch, right? You left the house.
Yes, not initially, but yes.
Not initially, but at some point you left before all this happened, right?
Yes.
All right. And you didn't have to come back there after that, right?
Yes, I did have to come back.
Okay. And that was to get your stuff?
Yes.
So your stuff was very important to you?
Yes, I had to get a pack on my stuff.
So you come back to the house and now Alicia's awake, is that right?
Yes, I think she was awake.
Okay. She's wearing her robe?
Yes.
And getting ready for the day?
I don't know what she was doing.
You don't know what she was doing. Okay. And you could have left at any time again, correct? The house, after you came back, before this happened, you could have left again, right?
Yeah, I could have left.
Your car, your truck wasn't blocked in the drive, or it was in front of the house, right?
Yes, much of it was in front of the house.
You had your car keys, you could have left.
Yes.
And you didn't?
No.
Even when she said the things to you that made you so mad about the new person she was dating, you could have just left, right?
Yes, it's a lot of things that you did.
That's correct. A lot of decisions you made that day, right? Then yes?
Yes.
One after the other, right?
I don't get where you're going.
Okay, well, let's go over the decisions that you made that day. You made a decision to go get that gun out of that table, correct?
I don't get what you're asking.
You decided to go get the gun out of the white table in the foyer, right?
Yes.
And in order to do that, you had to walk over to the table, right?
Yes.
So you step. You're thinking step forward, right?
I can say what I was thinking.
So you just accidentally walked over to the table?
I don't remember exactly how everything went. It just was happening so fast. I wasn't putting no thought. I didn't put thought into it.
Okay. So you walk over to the table, open the drawer, correct?
Yes.
Because the gun was in the drawer?
Yes.
And was the gun already loaded?
It had to be clearly.
Okay. So, safety was on?
I don't think that gun has a safety.
You don't think the Glock has? Okay. Did you have to put a gun in the bullet in the chamber? Or was there already a bullet in the chamber?
I'm thinking it had to be one already in the chamber.
Okay. And you had to pick up that gun with your left hand, right?
I don't know what hand I picked it up with.
But you held it in your left hand because you're left-handed at some point.
Yes.
Because that's your dominant hand, right?
Yes.
And you said to the police that Alicia saw you with the gun and said, what are you going to do with that, or something to that effect.
Yes.
And as a result of that, you didn't just leave the house, right? You stayed at the house.
Yes, correct.
The gun in your hand.
Yes.
And then you said you decided to hit her in the head with the gun.
You said I said what?
That you decided to hit her in the head with that gun.
I don't know if I said I decided to hit her in the head, but like I say, everything was happening so fast, I didn't put thought into it. It's like I wasn't in my right mind.
Right.
I can't say what I was thinking, like you're asking me.
Okay, so you just accidentally hit someone in the head who you were mad at.
You said what?
You were mad at her, right?
You said I was mad at her?
Yeah.
I was more hurt and embarrassed. I wasn't really, I don't know. I don't really know. It just happened so fast.
So it happened so fast. Okay, so you hit her in the head with the gun, right?
Clearly, that's evident.
I'm sorry, what?
That's everything from the video.
Okay, I'm not talking about shooting her. I'm talking about hitting her in the head with the actual body of the gun.
I don't even know if I actually hit her. That's what I'm saying. You see me.
Okay, but you must have swung your hand that was holding a gun.
Yes,
her head.
Yes.
Okay, another decision you make.
Yes.
And then whether or not you actually made contact with her head with that gun, she then ran away towards that bedroom, right?
Evidence from the interview.
And so when she did that, again, you're holding a gun. She's got no weapons, correct?
I didn't know what she had. I don't know.
And so you could have left the house in there, right?
There's a lot of things I could have did.
That's not what I asked you, though. I asked you, you could have left the house, right?
Yes.
And you didn't, right?
No, that's evident, no.
And so instead, what you decided to do was follow her to the bedroom that she ran towards, right?
Yeah, that's evident.
Okay, and then the door is now shut. She shut the door behind her, right?
Yes, that's everything.
And instead of, again, turning around and leaving, putting the gun down, even bringing the gun with you as you left, you decided to kick in the door, right?
Like I said, things are happening so fast, it's not what I, but it's not a decision that I just consciously made.
So you're just like sleepwalking?
It didn't. You know, I don't even know how to describe it, to be honest. Like, it just, like I say, it just didn't, I don't know. It just happened so fast. Like, it don't even feel like, it just didn't, I don't know. I don't know what I was doing,
okay,
to be honest.
But you kicked down that door.
Yeah, that's what I did.
And once you opened the door by kicking it down, you saw Alicia climbing out the window, right?
Yes, yes.
And instead of, again, turning around and leaving that house, which you were free to do, you chased after her, right?
I didn't. However you would word it.
Well,
I don't like I say, you asking me questions. I didn't put thought into what was going on. If I put thought into what was going on, none of these events were going to happen. So you asking me what I was thinking. Yeah. And I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I can't answer the question the way you want me to answer the question.
Okay, but ultimately you followed her, right, chased her?
Ultimately, all these events happened, and that's the reason why I'm here.
So you admit that you killed Alicia?
Yes.
And you admit that you shot her 15 times?
I didn't know how many times. I didn't sit there and count.
You shot her until it ran out of bullets?
That's, I don't know. I don't even know if it was, what was left. If it was any more bullets, I don't know.
And you shot her even though she was trying to escape the house?
Well, yeah, yeah.
And you shot her as she was lying in a heap on the grass beneath the window?
I don't know if that's when it happened. You asked me a specific question that I can't answer.
You shot her as she was lying on the ground beneath the window, did you?
I don't know if she was lying on the ground.
Well, she certainly wasn't running anymore.
I wasn't paying attention to think like that. I wasn't thinking like, let me watch and see where she was at, how she was moving. I wasn't thinking like that. I wasn't in my right mind to think like that.
But you were firing that gun one after another.
Well, you can say that, yes.
I can say that?
No, I'm saying you.
So that's
how you want to put it, yes.
So that's a yes. Firing that gun, yes. 15 times.
If that's what you said, yes.
And then you left the house. At that point, that is when you decided to leave, correct?
Yes, I left.
And you left her there dying on the grass.
Yes, I left.
And you decided that you wanted to go say goodbye to the people in your life that are important to you.
Yeah, I wanted to go say goodbye, yeah.
But that was after you threw the gun somewhere, right?
Yes.
Got rid of the gun, right?
Yeah, yes.
You didn't call 911 to get medical treatment for her, did you?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, you didn't care if she died, did you? You wanted her to die.
I didn't know if she was dead. I didn't know if she died or anything. I didn't know. I didn't even know the extent of what happened. I don't know. Things were happening so fast. I didn't sit there to gauge everything. I just know that things happened and I got it going.
All right, and the person who made you mad was now dead, correct?
The person that made me
mad. Alicia was dead, and she had made you mad, right?
Yes, she was dead.
And she had made you mad before you killed her, right?
Yes, if that's what you want to say.
No, this is not about what I want to say.
You leaded me with the questions when you asked me just, you know, the person that made me mad and all of this. You know what you want, it's crazy.
Mr. Lofton.
Yes.
You're on your own?
Yes, I know.
Try to answer the question. Try to answer the question as best
you can. Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
The person who you were mad at, your wife, was now dead at your hands, correct?
Like I said at the time, I didn't notice she was dead.
You didn't notice she was dead?
No, I didn't.
You didn't notice the blood coming out of her?
No.
The shell casings littered around the body?
I didn't.
Okay, well then why'd you leave?
Because I knew something had happened after sitting there and coming back, like hearing these gunshots, I know something had to happen. It didn't matter if she was dead or not. I'm saying I had to get up out of there because I knew that something happened and I knew I had to leave and I just left.
Because you were going to be arrested, right?
Exactly.
And you were trying to get away.
No, I wasn't trying to get away from being arrested. That's why I turned myself in.
And you acknowledge that in order for a gun to be fired, you have to pull the trigger, right?
Yes.
So you had to pull that trigger 15 times.
Yes, apparently. Mm-hmm.
But after days of testimony and hours of deliberation, the jury came back with something no one expected. They couldn't agree. Deadlocked, stuck, unable to reach a unanimous verdict. And just like that, the judge had no choice. A mistrial was declared. After months of gearing up for a second trial, Marcus changed course. No more waiting. No more rolling the dice with another jury. Instead of risking a first-degree murder conviction, he took the deal. A plea over the possibility of facing 12 people who might see straight through him again. He pleaded no contest to second-degree murder, avoiding the possibility of a harsher sentence in a retrial. He also pleaded guilty to the associated firearm charges. During sentencing, the judge didn't mince words. The court noted the brutality of the act, the repeated shots, the violation of a protective order, and the danger to the community. Marcus received 25 to 50 years for second-degree murder, 2 years for felony firearm, sentences to run consecutively. At 44, that sentence guarantees he'll spend decades, likely the rest of his life, behind bars. He offered no meaningful apology, no remorse. Nothing beyond the same story he'd already told, a story no one in that courtroom believed. Alicia's aunt said it made sense in hindsight that Alicia never introduced Marcus to the family. To her, that silence meant something. Maybe that Alicia felt he wasn't someone worth bringing home. Her father didn't hold back either. He called Marcus a piece of garbage and said plainly that if the law didn't bind him, Marcus wouldn't be walking out of that courtroom alive. And then there was Alicia's daughter, the one who lost the most. She told him he took the greatest support system they had, but that even after everything he tried to destroy, they would still rise. And he would still be the one rotting in a cell. For them, the sentence wasn't closure, but it was accountability, finally. It's strange how much energy people pour into polishing the surface of their lives, the photos, the jokes, the coordinated outfits, while the truth leaks out through the cracks they try hardest to hide. That's the thing about hashtag couple goals. It's often more performance than partnership, a highlight reel designed to distract from the parts that don't photograph well. And sometimes, the louder the display, the darker the reality beneath it. Marcus always cared about the image, the clothes, the swagger, the reputation. He built an entire persona around being the man everyone else wanted to be. But personas are just costumes. And eventually, the real story shows up anyway. Because here's the part his defense could never outrun. Forensic examiners found bullet paths that traced her exact movements. Shots fired as she climbed out the window. Shots fired as she hit the ground, and shots fired downward while she lay on the grass below. That isn't blackout. That isn't blur or panic. That's precision. That's pursuit. That's someone making sure the outcome didn't change. Marcus said he couldn't hear shit, couldn't see shit, that everything was blurry. But blurry doesn't track a moving target. Blurry doesn't follow someone out a window. And blurry doesn't walk to the ledge and fire down at a body that's no longer fighting back. Marcus tried to manage the narrative. But in the end, the evidence did the talking. And the truth wrote an ending he couldn't Photoshop, delete, or outrun. That's the story of Alicia Danielle Lofton. Thank you so much for listening today. If you're enjoying these stories, don't forget to follow and leave a review. It helps more than you know. I'll see you in the next one. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.